and welcome to another episode of Radio Warner. The day today is May 18th, 2026, and this is episode 608. I am the co-host of Radio Warner, coming to you from the western part of the Empire State of New York. You are listening to Radio Warner. Subscribe and support the show. Go to patreon.com/Radio Warner and become part of the Warner Legion. I'm on the line, of course, with the Warner, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, in southern Italy. John, how are you?
I'm fine. It's a busy time, but we have a really serious episode about World War II, so I guess we should just get to that.
Yeah, this has been a very popular series, our series with Annibale on Operation Barbarossa. This is part 10, and this will be the final part. There's going to be a lot to pack into it.
Yeah.
So let's first welcome back to the show our good friend and guest, Annibale. Welcome back, Annibale.
Thank you very much for having me back. As usual, very glad to be here with you.
So are we, and I think so are our subscribers who really love this series. And today, we are going to finish it up with the Battle of Moscow, the part where the bad guys lose. But it gets a lot more complicated and interesting than that. So why don't you introduce the episode? I'm sorry. One thing I wanted to say before we do this, just one little thing I wanted to note here, because when you talk about the furthest German advance, I should have said this the last episode, the furthest German advance towards Moscow. So when I was still out there, so this is the year 2000, actually, when kind of eras are changing from the Yeltsin era to the Putin era. There was a huge controversy because IKEA opened their first big giant store in Moscow. And it was a big deal. It really was a big deal. Certainly in 2000, this is...
I remember. Yeah. Catherine and I went out there and in the snow.
Yes. Yeah, like the Germans, huh? And so it was a big deal also because they were just coming out of the financial crisis that started in the middle of 1998. And like basically there were no goods anywhere. And the few goods that were there maybe were like extremely expensive. And they were just kind of starting to really the economy and the way it was working was starting to change. So IKEA coming there was a big deal. And it was mired in controversy because they opened this up in the sort of, was a Western suburb, Himki Chemicals, big town, Himki. And it was off a big road. I think it was Leningradske Chaussee. And IKEA built it just outside of the city limits of Moscow. So they already pissed off Moscow by depriving them of certain bribes and taxes. But they also wanted to build this off-ramp, a special IKEA off-ramp, that basically went right over the famous tank traps there, which are a memorial to the war.
Ah.
And yeah, and this was basically no Westerners. I went back and looked at even how the New York Times wrote about it, and I remember how the Moscow Times. No Westerners took it seriously at all. They just thought, it's just a tank trap, and Russia's a joke, and why would they seriously care? They just want to extract bribes, and I'm sure bribery was a part of it, but... this was a big deal, you know, and it's great that we're doing this series to remind people, you know, how epic, as they say, this Operation Barbarossa and this Battle of Moscow was, and this monument was, and everybody sided with IKEA, whose owner, by the way, was a Nazi youth member.
Yep,
in Sweden.
Yep. Exactly.
So, to add to all
precisely.
The irony. So
precisely.
Anyway,
it was this concoction of Nazi and hippie. It's,
yes.
Yeah. It's absolutely.
It's a thing. Nazi.
It's very relevant. But back then, it was the moment where most of the anti-Soviet hysteria of the 90s was starting very rapidly to dwindle down.
Yes.
And there was this very speedy recovery of, you know, the history of the Great Patriotic War.
Yes.
And it was very rapid. It went from, let's say, 1999. 1999 was the year when Enemy at the Gate was released, and Enemy at the Gate started to, you know, was very unpopular with a lot of people in Russia, particularly with veterans or people who were professional in studying the Great Patriotic War. And there were protests, actually, and they tried to have the film censored. And it was, this was not done. A lot of people saw that and they started to say, oh my God, we are being treated like clowns. Mm-hmm. And in very few years, the whole thing has changed. I mean, there was this huge return to, you know, particularly, I mean, there are a lot of memorials and monuments, mm-hmm. of course, in Russia. And some of them are very important, like Mamayev Kurgan in Stalingrad or Volgograd, as it's called right now, the Prokhorovka bell tower in Prokhorovka. And but there are also, I mean, there is a many small memorial that may be, you know, statues or and there, I mean, I was, even myself, I was surprised to understand that right now, there is a lot of young people, probably, I mean, there is a return of nationalism, there is the war, whatever, maybe there is an, that they are interested in that, particularly this idea about, for instance, younger people going down and trying to find the bodies of people who were killed during the war, giving them a proper burial. Yeah, and this is quite interesting. So, yes, at the moment, I mean, the pre-Putin transition, and there was this moment where everybody around 1999, 2000, where everybody say, oh, the world memory of, you know, World War II, a Russian front is over, is gone. And I mean, I remember it was also 1998, I think, that the Saving Private Ryan was released. Mm-hmm. It was the high tide of the idea, war, Band of Brothers, you know, the whole idea, oh, World War II was basically the Western Front and D-Day and everything else was. And then, I mean, this whole thing changed very rapidly.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, I think, I mean, the World War II memory was always, I think, very, remained very popular with the non-elites outside of the two or three big cities. But among sort of younger people and intellectual elites and liberals and so on, they were embarrassed, but they didn't want to talk about it. And that changed really fast between 99, 2000, and onward from there. So, yeah. So, let's get to, well, what are you going to talk about this episode?
Okay, we are going to talk about the Soviet counteroffensive in front of Moscow. And this started really with a bang, a huge bang, because it started with what may be the most eventful week of World War II, that is, starting from December 5th, the day the Soviet counteroffensive in front of Moscow starts, continuing with December 7th, the day of Pearl Harbor, and ending with December 11th, the day when Hitler declares war on the United States. It's the week where everything changes. The nature of World War II changes, the nature of the 20th century changes, mm-hmm. because I mean what happens after that is and you know the Cold War, the post-Europe equilibrium and everything else, it really starts with that week, the moment, because I mean just imagine that is the German army has reached is screeching is grinding halt, you know, they're frozen. Stop. They're being stopped in place by the cold, in part, but mostly by the Soviet resistance in front of Moscow. They are inching forward. At some point, they cannot inch forward anymore. And then all of a sudden, December 5th, the first of the counteroffensive starts. It starts in the north. And then 2 days later, Pearl Harbor, and you know, the people in the Wolfschanze and Hitler try to frantically to understand where Pearl Harbor is and what's going on. And then Hitler, in a whim, on December 11, deciding he wants to have a two-fronts war, and who cares? Devil may care. We're going to win. We have an ally. Japan was not being defeated in 2,000 years, and blah, 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 blah. And it's huge. It's great. It's something that transcends completely even the dimension of Barbarossa, because this is really World War II becoming a war, you know. Mm. There is, on both hemispheres, there's people fighting each other, people killing each other. But in this context, it's very easy, and this is what did happen in historiography, in the memory of World War II, to lose track of what really did happen in front of Moscow in December, June, and February, December 1941 and January and February 1942. Because this is one of the moments of the Wall Eastern Front of World War II that is more controversial, most misunderstood, and has been most subject to different school of thought, even in a subject that is controversial as the Eastern Front. Even in that context, the world vision that we have of the Soviet counteroffensive and the results of the Soviet counteroffensive, or the lack of results to some extent, the results of also the lack of results of the Soviet counteroffensive and the political windfall that it had both in Germany, in, you know, in relationship what did happen to Hitler and what did happen after World War II and the memory of World War II, but also in the Soviet Union first and Russia later. We are going to discuss four moments, four impulses of the counteroffensive. From December 5th to December 16th, that is the opening counteroffensive, that is tightly coordinated, operationally limited, but very effective. Then from December 16 to December 31 is the first expansion of objectives. There is the complete collapse of the German command structure, because Hitler starts to sack everybody and replace everybody on the high command with people he likes more than those Prussian professional soldier. And then there is the Hitler Halt Befehl, the stop now, the stop on your track, don't move anymore order he is giving to the troops. Then there is, in January, there is...
You mean no more retreating,
basically. No more retreat. Okay. No, I say halt befehl, right. Halt order, okay? The order to stop, don't retreat.
Did you ever play that computer game Doom in the 90s? And there's like you kill zombie Nazis and they always go, halten Sie, when you come in to shoot them.
Oh, no, this was not Doom.
Oh, Wolfenstein, maybe.
Wolfenstein, that's
yeah,
it.
Yeah, that's right,
that's
yeah, yeah.
It. Wolfenstein.
Hard to see. Yes.
Yeah, boomers. They are called boomer shooter. They call it boomer shooters.
That's good.
Oh, they are fun. They're absolutely fun. Yeah. And then January 1942, there is just starting general offensive, and this general offensive has also some political implication, in particular in Stalin relationship with the Allies, and we're going to discuss about that. And this is the moment where there is the overreach that dominates the second part of the Soviet offensive. And then in February, March, there is this general crisis of the Soviet push toward westward, and the Germans stabilize, and the front is hardening around the above-mentioned Rzhev salient. Rzhev is very important, and we're going to take a bit of time to discuss that, because, again, is one of the most controversial moment of Soviet and Russian military history of the 20th century. Now, in order to continue, you need to understand that the core historiographical tension. There is the Western historiography that was shaped by German memoirs, long frame this period primarily as a story about Hitler Alte Befehl, saving, quotes, Army Group Center. Okay. Something like, yeah, he was mad. Yes, he was always putting his nose where it was not supposed to do. But yeah, he did save us. He did save the army with this stubborn decision to stop the retreat and to make everybody defend in place. This was further complicated later on, particularly when David Sahel did his monography about the retreat from Moscow, about the Soviet offensive, where he said, yes, the order was real, but its causal weight has been overstated. The German defensive success was as much the result of Soviet operational limitation as to, you know, Hitler's rigidity. And then this was somehow, you know, following the lead from David Glantz, what definitely shifted the frame towards the Soviet side, saying, oh, there were planning assumptions. Some of those planning assumptions went wrong in January. And it's the Red Army performance revealing something about its own state of development. So it's more interesting probably to check what the Soviet did instead of being obsessed about what the German did. Mm-hmm. Strategic situation on December 5th. The German side is broken. It's a broken offensive machine. At the divisional level, Army Group Center, Panzer Group, has suffered catastrophic attrition in men, horses, and vehicles, particularly across November. The continuation of the offensive after the end of the Rasputitsa and the ground hardening because of the cold was a disaster. The attrition was absolutely beyond any kind of scale that the Wehrmacht could suffer. The 3rd and 4th Panzer Group before Moscow were absolutely shadows of their June 1941 formation, okay? Still able to work somehow as offensive machine on a very limited scale against very smaller Soviet and tired and broken down Soviet defenders, but absolutely, it's there is no comparison. Is the strongest army in the world that right now has become a wreck? Okay. Mm-hmm. Most important thing: this broken offensive machine, and this is something that a lot of people will find probably amazing, but this is the truth. Guess what? Germany. The Wehrmacht command has no made allowance for prepared defensive positions. The Wehrmacht transitioned to defense all of a sudden without defensive lines because planning had assumed a continued advance. Now, if you check the German Stellung, the defensive position map for December 1941, you see that they had planned fallback lines located 10 to 15 kilometers behind their forward position, but those positions were never dug up because the offensive was assumed to continue. Okay, so this is most fantastic level of self-deception.
It's one of the reasons, maybe because they were also exhausted and, you know, you can only have your resources do so much as you've driven so far and you've been worn down. Or is this just complete arrogance?
No. Wait. If, I mean, someone rational, the last rational person in the entire Wehrmacht say, wait, we should probably make some kind of thinking or in relation with the possibility of having to go into the defensive. So maybe we should dig this, you know, defensive line 10 to 15 kilometers behind our forward position. Maybe we should take a small reserve and keep this reserve there. Maybe, you know, an armor reserve and having this resupplied and replenished in just in case. And everybody else say, no.
Right.
This will take off time and we need to use this time and those resources to press on. Because why? Why this? Because they are convinced and they are going to be convinced about this until December 11th, at least, that the Soviets are on their last leg.
Right.
They have not reserved. They're going to collapse. And you see that in the document. You see that in the discussion they have.
That's incredible. It took them even another week into this to figure that out. It's just, it's mind-boggling because this is the assumption you've been talking about this since the first episode of your series, that they're constantly surprised. They think they're going to face 200 divisions and suddenly they're realizing it's actually 350, 400. Like, they don't even, they're constantly underestimating, but having been caught out, underestimating is never, it's like, huh, we underestimated 10 times now. Maybe the 11th time we shouldn't underestimate. Mm-hmm. It's mind-blowing. Yeah.
And keep in mind that that is not we assumed that there were no Soviet reserve left because we never saw any Soviet reserve. No, because on November 28th, there is aerial reconnaissance already reporting that there are railways movement and automobile activity near automotive, more automobile, I mean motor activity near Moscow as early as November 28th. And so they say, wow, there are a lot of trains, freight trains, and, you know, trucks and tanks converging on Moscow. And maybe they should think maybe something is going on. Okay. And at this point, by November 28th, they should have say, wait, maybe they're thinking about a counteroffensive. We need to take some countermeasure. No, they decided November 28th, I mean, even December 4th, they actually are pushing their best armor formation, best between quotes, I mean, the remaining armor formation, even deeper into Soviet position. And there is a great example for that. That is the 41st Panzer Corps that was near Kalinin, waiting for fuel. And Zhukov at some point started to say, whoa, there is this huge, and was still rather huge, the German 41st Panzer Corps. And Zhukov is being told, there is this huge Panzer Corps south of Kalinin, and they're clearly waiting to be resupplied with fuel. And Zhukov started to say, well, maybe they are going to use it to counterattack near Maloyaroslavets or Serpukhov, and where actually is they are the objective of one of the thirst of the Soviet offensive. But when the fuel finally arrive, instead, the 41st Panzer Corps, instead of being held in reserve near Klin or somewhere around Klin as a precaution, is sent even deeper into the Soviet position in the area north of Moscow, near the Moscow Canal, the worst possible position when the counteroffensive opened. This is absolutely a disaster. You take your best armor force that can be used for a counterattack, and you push it right into the jaws of the enemy. Okay, and this is done simply because there is an enormous operational ignorance. I mean, the Wehrmacht is simply ignoring the fact that there is a huge force, or there is wishful thinking. Is that yeah, there might be signs that they are going to counterattack, but we want to believe that they have no reserve left. Okay, so if any of those people had come to their senses at the end of November and said, enough, let us return to the starting position, the Soviet offensive would have been gone in trouble right from the start. But it didn't happen. Okay. Now, Zhukov Western Front had...
Sorry, can you explain that? Like, why wouldn't the Russian forces have continued pushing westward with little opposition?
The Red Army in 1941 had this limit on the use because of, you know, experience, because of organizational problem. I mean, there are many reasons. There are these huge problem on doing long time, I mean, long offensive using combined arms. They were very good at doing breakthrough and exploiting those breakthrough on the, you know, on the shorter term. But when they started to have to use combined arms like armor and infantry and aviation.
On a large scale.
In coordinated fashion. They had huge problems with that. So these created a German mindset. This was part German standard operational doctrine, and in part the result of what they saw during Barbarossa in 1941. The Germans started to have this routine deployment of strong armored forces on the 10 to 15 kilometers, 20 kilometers, on the back on their front line to be used as stopgap measure to close a hole in the front as soon as it is what opened by the Soviets. Okay. And when they could do that, when they had enough force, they had a clear operational picture of what was going on the front, and they had good commanders, they could stop, on a limited fashion, they could stop any Soviet breakthrough. What did happen from 1943, but particularly in 1944, Bagration and so on and so forth, is that first the Soviets started to create those tank armies, huge tank armies with, you know, to 11,000 to 17,000 people inside and thousands of tanks that were a mixture of infantry, tanks, and artillery that could be used independently, and they were huge. They could create huge the breakthrough, the deep battle, you know, the deep battle theory. And they were very difficult to stop because the local superiority was overwhelming. And particularly, they were so rapid that very often this happened, most famously in the Vistula Oder operation in 1945, when the breakthrough by Ivan Konev, first Ukrainian front on the Krakow axis, was so rapid that the two German panzer division that were held in reserve to counterattack found themselves already with the Soviets on their back. Okay, because they were so quick, the two German division were overrun, completely overrun. They say, "Well, they are in front of us. No, they are on our back, and we are cut off." Okay, but in 1941, this was not possible because the Soviet had brigades tank brigades. Those brigades were smaller. They were much easier to coordinate by, you know, green commanders, young people that had been put into command position because of this huge attrition the Soviet army was experiencing. But much easier to manage, but much less effective against coordinated counterattack. In this case, there was no reserve force. The Germans had everybody and everyone on the front line. And right. Once a breakthrough was made, there was right. Nothing in the back. Okay?
Yeah. That's incredible. So
there, at the beginning of the counteroffensive, the operational concept designed by Zhukov, and then we are going to, I will have to open a small aside, is Zhukov, but actually it was probably not just Zhukov, there was also Boris Shaposhnikov, the Stalin chief of staff, that had a hand into designing the offensive. The operational concept initially was limited, and that was deliberately limited because they knew that the objective was clear. We need to relieve the pressure on Moscow through coordinated local attacks, not strategic encirclement. And Zhukov understood that his forces were not capable of deep operation exploitation in December 1941. In December 1943, they could do that. Just 2 years later, they were absolutely able to do that, not in December 1941. Now, they had Zhukov and the Red Army had this asset, the ace in the sleeve. They were the Siberian and Far Eastern Division. They were fresh, equipped for winter, psychologically very crucial. But remember, they had not enough weight to change completely the picture. Most of the December counteroffensive was conducted by exhausted formations supplemented with those fresh reserves. They were not replaced. The Siberian and Far Eastern Division did not replace the division that had been defending Moscow.
But they made great dramatic effect, though, for film. But yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what was the state of Russian anxiety about Japanese intervention at that point?
Oh, at this point, no. At this point, there was none. None is an exaggeration. Of course, I mean, Stalin was always suspecting the probability of something, you know, good old paranoia. And the idea that maybe his intelligence sources were wrong. But it was very clear that Japan was making signals saying, we're not interested, we're not going to have that, we're going to go south, we're interested in getting the oil of the all those Dutch oil fields in Indonesia and having the Philippines and so on and so forth. And it was very clear Soviet intelligence had a very clear picture of what was going on in the Manchukuo and in Manchuria, and it was clear there was not,
in a sense, didn't Pearl Harbor pretty much, you know, end that worry? I mean, of course, not completely, but pretty much ended, because Japan's already fighting, in a sense, a two-front war in China and Southeast Asia, and now America. What's it going to open up a third front against the Soviet Union? So who had already lost against?
No. By the way, there were signs about that. I mean, it's the moment where after 1 week after Pearl Harbor, there was no sign of Japan. And even after Hitler had decided to declare war on the U.S., there was no Japanese declaration of war on Soviet Union. It was pretty clear that Japan was. But this was almost, there were definitely signs, both open and secret signs, that Japan was, you know, minding his own business and deciding to have a completely different war. Right. And they were much more anxious about the possibility. One of the things that Stalin was worrying was, first, that once the the United States were at war with Japan, the attention of the United States will move away from the possibility to, you know, send material, that war land lease thing. Say, okay, they are and full with fighting the Japanese and in the Pacific, and they are losing. By the way, the war at the beginning, first 6 months, didn't go very well for the Allies. And so maybe they are going to get back on their word about helping us and are not going to send us the material they promised us.
Right. Wasn't there a wartime Soviet joke, something like, describe three myths of the 20th century? And the first one was the Second Front.
But, well, there were thousands of jokes about that. They became really bitter about that later on, particularly around Stalingrad, because that was the moment where they said, well, you're supposed to do something to relieve the pressure on us, and you're not doing anything. And you are not even the excuse of, you know, having to deal with those pesky Japanese. And but... the idea, at some point in December 16, Anton Eden flies to Moscow. One of the reasons he is going there is to reassure Stalin, okay, we are going to help you. We are not forgot about you. Your effort for us is very important. It's very important for Britain. It's very important for the U.S., and one of the reasons why at some point Stalin decided he wanted to have this offensive that initially was just limited to try to relieve Moscow, to try to have it as a strategic offensive and drive, destroy Army Group Center or drive Army Group Center all the way back to the Dnieper, is to show the Western Allies that... Soviet Union is on the offensive. Soviet Union is not finished. Soviet Union is not crippled. And beside, you know, making a stand, making a brilliant defensive fight, they are able to counterattack. They are able to have an active role on defeating.
To go on the offensive against the Nazi war machine.
Exactly.
Because
There is some indication there may have been some pressure in this sense, from the Western Allies, but particularly from Britain, say, well, yeah, go on, do this. Because, of course, putting pressure on Germany meant that Germany could not send, in particular, it was important for Britain, because this meant that any kind of help Germany could send to Africa to help Rommel was going to stay in Soviet Union.
Right.
And so the Stavka intelligent picture was that Soviet operation planning was very accurate on showing how the German offensive capacity was exhausted, but crucially had some huge blind spot regarding German defensive resilience. Okay, they didn't underestimate that. But the idea was that the Kalinin Front, was under Konev on the north, Western Front under Zhukov in the center, and the right wing of the Southwestern Front around Tula were the main operational arms. Now, the first attack came from the 30th Army, commanded by Lei Lushenko, that is going to become one of the most outstanding tank commander of the Soviet Army. And it was huge. 9 fresh division assembled in the 30th Army, and this included the 348 that was coming from the Urals, the 371 that was came from Chelyabinsk, and the 82nd came from Bashkiria. And these did attack the flank of the 3rd and 4th Panzer Group with the aim of cutting the main supply lines of the Panzer Group. Now, it's important to say that when this happened, there is immediately on the German side this panic. It's interesting because it shows how all panics are resemble each other. Mm-hmm. They start to say, oh my God, the Siberians are coming, the Siberians mm-hmm. are coming. And it's interesting that they were, the German, one of the reasons why we have this vision of Siberians division being overwhelmingly on the front during the Soviet offensive is that Germans were saying that. And they would say, oh my God, we'll be attacked by the Siberians, because anybody with a certain kind of cloth, like sheepskin coat,
white outfits,
and so they're Siberians, right. But they were not necessarily, some of them they were, but there is this idea, the Siberians are coming, run away, and in this case, there is a real collapse. And at this point, they cave in. The defense on the north just cave in, and they start to have a retreat that becomes in a couple of days a rout, more or less a rout. And then there is the moment where the panic starts to spread. Now, there is a huge problem in the command atmosphere in the German army right now, because the chief of the OKH, Brauchitsch, is very ill. And Alder, if you read Franz Alder, this chief of staff diary, you see that they are starting to panic. And the most important thing is that both Alder and Bock, that is the commander of the Army Group Center, they start to say, one thing is that there is panic spreading among the troop, but also we cannot control our field commanders anymore. Every field commander beginning to act independently and ignoring OKH directive, because they have been told to do that. They have been trained to do that, you know.
They've been trained to like take personal initiative? And
the whole thing, Aufgestrattig, this culture on the idea that is you need to understand the intent of your command and decide autonomously. But at this point, they are probably even ignoring the intent of the command. So at the Panzer Group level, people like Guderian, it's very difficult to control. Okay, and so this make a defensive operation very difficult. Now, on the Soviet side, there is this idea, you see a bit of the mirror side of this. Zhukov command doctrine at Moscow was very ruthless. The Zhukov operating principle during that period was no surrender, no retreat, counterattack wherever and whenever possible, and go on defensive, who cares about the losses, okay? It's very ruthless. This is the moment where this offensivist culture where in order to achieve results, you need to losses are a secondary fact. Mm. And this is going to create this ruthlessness as operational method means that you are Zhukov or whatever, or any other commander is achieving results, but at a cost that will make keeping those results going impossible. Mm. Okay. Is an operational style that more or less accepted very high exchange rates for territorial objective that were conscious common philosophy. Sometimes, I mean, German memoirs, they tell you they were having eye losses because the commanders were incompetent. This is not true. They were having huge losses because in this phase, they thought those losses were worth taking in order to achieve those territorial objectives. Which may be right, may be wrong. In a situation, keep in mind that we are not discussing Napoleonic War, okay? We're not discussing even World War One, a war where one has the time and the possibility to try to make conservative decisions in order to achieve your results. This kind of finesse is impossible in a situation where it's really life or death. Still, there is this mixture of, on one side, Zhukov willing to do whatever is necessary in order to reach the objectives. And on the other hand, Stalin, that on one side sometimes tell, well, we are not going to go for a huge encirclement because this is going to be dangerous. But when he sees a strategic objective and senses, is smelling the possibility of a huge strategic victory, say, well, all caution is thrown to the wind, let's go on, and who cares about what happens? And so it's Stalin's ambition for encirclement very often outran Zhukov's assessment of what was operationally achievable. And at the same time, Zhukov sometimes they say, okay, I think we are going to have these objectives and win this battle, and I'm willing to, you know, have such and such material and human losses. And who cares if at the end we are going to achieve the results we have planned? Now, it's important also to understand a bit of meteorological context, because one of the great myths of this phase of the war and the entire battle around Moscow is that the general winter thing, you know, the Germans could not win because the weather was against them. But you have to remember, it's not as simple as that. Because the moment where the winter, 1941-1942 winter, becomes absolutely, you know, unusual, with temperatures plunging down well below the average, even the Russian average, the Moscow average, is the moment where the Soviet counteroffensive starts. So it's General Winter is more hampering the Soviets than the German.
Yeah.
But and still, this will give you a sense of, in fact, how much the Soviet did achieve during the offensive. Because still, even if they were going at minus 20 at noon in 1 meter of snow, they still managed to break through the German line and inflict losses to the German, and in the north and the south make substantial forward advance. Okay.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, the Russians are not like, you know, snow people or something. It's very hard to advance in that kind of harsh, brutal weather for anybody. But it was probably more of a shock for the Germans. They were probably less prepared for it. The Russians might be more prepared for it. But you'd much rather be in a defensive position when you have a cold snap like that, or like a brutal winter snap like that, than to be on the offensive.
Yes. And again, there is this kind of strange dichotomy where we are seeing that the winter conditions are hampering and slowing down the Soviet offensive much more than they did hamper slow down the German offensive. Mm-hmm. But the psychological effect is much more severe on the Germans, yes, on the defender. And this is what you see. I mean, Michael Jones did a fantastic work. And there is this book, I'm going to put it in the bibliography, call it The Retreat, where he is discussing the memoirs, the letters, and the diaries of the German soldiers during the battle for Moscow, during the Soviet offensive for the Battle of Moscow. And the shock is enormous. Mm-hmm. They say, oh my God, they are going, it's sort of the perfect nightmare. We are so tired, we went just inches away from the ultimate prize of Moscow, and now we are broken, and we were told that the Soviets were much more broken than we were, that we are now. And now, no, they are attacking us, and they are attacking us in this awful mm-hmm. winter condition. There is nowhere where we... It's a shock.
Yes.
There is a moment where a sense of panic, but a sense also of defeat, of, how do you call it, of resignation.
Doomerism.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, we're not going to go anywhere. I mean, yeah. we're lost. And everybody, of course, this is the moment where the idea that the specter of Napoleon fate in Russia is, you know, hovering about the German army. Everybody remembers about that. We're going to have this retreat in winter, and it's going to be a disaster like that. And so the psychological impact is huge, and there is a coordinated effort by the German propaganda, particularly in the first 30 days of the offensive, to shield the German population as much as possible from mm-hmm. what's going on. And they are doing that. It's interesting, by the way, to see how this effort is also flowing down also in the Italian propaganda at the time. Mm. So there is the moment where at some moment, you know, as if by magic, all news from the Eastern Front stop. It's like, you see that it's very funny in the Italian newspaper. It's very interesting to read that on the Italian newspaper, the Italian dailies. So there's on the third... The Germans, December 3rd, the Germans are almost on Moscow. Yeah. December 4th, the Germans are almost in Moscow. December 5th, the Germans are almost in Moscow. December 6th,
you should try this new restaurant in Rome. It's really good.
it's December 6th. Oh, no, the Italian Navy had a victorious engagement with the British Navy in the Mediterranean. Right. And December 7th, did we talk about the Italian engagement in the Mediterranean in front of
Malta? It was really, really good. Yeah. Let's go over exactly. it again. Yeah.
And then you're going to hear again from the Eastern Front 1 month later, like, yeah, well, you know, we're in defensive position. We're just recovering now, right now, because we need to restart the offensive when the winter ends.
I remember you've talked before about, what was that magazine for soldiers? Signal.
Yes.
Yeah. What was their take, if any?
There was no take. No, there was no take. The Signal was absolutely perfect on showing showing the interesting part of the waging war in Russia. That meant winning or exploiting, mercilessly exploiting. Mercilessly exploiting the local, the local, you know, resources, or a bit of sight and sighing when we were like in the Caucasus. So the summit of the Caucasus, there were beautiful mountains there.
Right.
Picture of people at home having parties, drinking cocktails, and so on and so forth. Or technology. I mean, that was the other thing, showing this is the new tank that we are, this is the new gun.
I was going to say technology. You know, and it'll work because people mostly do not want to believe things are going bad. I mean, it is a terrifying prospect. And so, you know, I think a lot of propaganda works when people would rather be lied to for as long as possible. So, yeah.
But remember that the huge problem German propaganda had in 1941, they had not the same problem later on, particularly after Stalingrad, because after Stalingrad they started to say, oh, guys, you have to get your act together, otherwise the Red Hordes are coming to your home and destroying your, eating all your reserve of krauts and würstels and so on and so forth. But in early 1941, it was very easy to exploit the idea that we're going to win very soon. But in late 1941 and early 1942, it was more difficult because the German public had been promised victory, imminent victory, and now victory was not coming, and there was this idea that we're to prepare the public for a long war, a war of materials, not a war of sweeping, brilliant offensive. And it was not easy. It's not easy to make this transition. So they started this, and they were very good at that, this half lying, half telling the truth, trying to show nudging. Right now it's called nudging. Okay, you're nudging people to a certain position, and they were pretty good on that, particularly because they had also a good booster of morale in summer 1942, where the advance toward the Caucasus seemed to go well until it didn't in November 1942. But this transition, this phase of transition, late 1941 to mid to late 1942, is interesting because is the propaganda start to be more nuanced, way less triumphalist than it used to be before. More, yes, we know the war is hard, but we will prevail in the end. And starting, by the way, to make sure people, the public at home, is always, always conscious of the inner superiority of Germany and the Western culture that Germany represents in comparison with, you know, the Bolshevik orders. You know, dehumanizing the enemy is always a good bet in this case. Mm-hmm. Remember, when you cannot boast about your victories, always, you know, make sure everybody understands that your enemy is inferior and will lose no matter what. And this is what they did, by the way. But when the Soviets were in advance, in 1941, they didn't have the story that was routine later on of the immense, the enormous amount of material and human and you know, raw materials Soviet Union had. They could not, you know, this became the cliche later on. In 1941, they could not say, oh, all of a sudden they had a lot of resources we were not aware of. So they started to say, it's the winter, it's a bit of bad luck, we need to regroup. We need to straighten out our defense line in order to have a good jumping point for offensive later on. This kind of lie, it's nothing new. Okay, mm-hmm. Everybody uses that even now. So the Northern Front attack on the December 5th, and they break through the German line. On December 6th, the Western Front attacks with two-pronged attack, north and south, immediately north and south of Moscow. And it's in the South, in particularly the 10th Army under Philip Golikov, near Tula and Stalinogorsk, as a major success, because the southern flank of Guderian's 2nd Panzer Army is really, really exposed, and the offensive is done really well. And they succeed, particularly where German units are logistically and tactically most broken. The German collapse is not universal, but is visible. Okay, and this is enough to make the Soviet commanders, you know, more hungry for more victories, more hungry for more advance. And as we always say, there is no worse teacher than success.
Mm-hmm. Did these advances come in a planned way at the expense of the lesser troops, the troops of the Nazi proxy regimes?
There were very few of them at the moment. It's not like 1942. This is a huge difference, by the way. It's also interesting to see from the propaganda point of view that in 1941, one excuse that was used later on after Stalingrad, our lies were in poor form,
right, yeah.
Were scoundrels, were cowards, were whatever, could not be used because there were no huge, large allies army like large Romanian, large Italian, large Hungarian army covering the front, the wings and the flanks of the German troops. Almost everybody was Germans there. They were actual Wehrmacht troops, and there were the Wehrmacht troops that were collapsing. So there was not this excuse, and this also was a huge, not huge, was an important reason for Hitler, and we're going to discuss this in a minute, for Hitler decided at some point to sack the German command, because it was easier for him to find a scapegoat into the commanders rather than saying, oh my God, our troops are collapsing because they are having enough, they are tired, they are broken, they are whatever. In Nazi mythology, the folk, you know, the will of the people, of course, of the people under the leadership of Hitler, of the Nazi regime, was unwavering, unbending. It was much easier for him to say, oh, is these all professional people, Prussian people inside the high command of the Wehrmacht in the OKAH, they have no enough willpower to continue.
They don't have enough magical willpower.
Yeah, exactly. And it was very easy to sell to the public.
Yeah.
It was very easy to sell to the public. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not the fault of your relatives, which I've sent to die in Russia without winter clothes and so on and so forth. Is that just the culprits? There are those people in command. I am sacking them and replacing
them with
better pants. It's
the elite fancy pants from the Prussian, from the Prussian
schools.
Yeah.
Again, nothing new under the sun.
Yep.
Okay. Coming back to the Soviet. The Soviet elders so started to discover they had, they knew about that, but there were some material limitations on the Soviet side that was important. For instance, one thing, there have been several interesting studies on that recently, is that a lot of the tanks that they were used, and remember, this is 1941, they are producing a lot of T-34, but T-34 is not yet the T-34 that is going to be used from 1942 onward, you know, the main Soviet battle tank. They still have a lot of different tanks for a previous era. One of them is the T-60, and the T-60 was the most numerous tank on the Western Front in late 1941, early 1942, and it had a lot of problem. It was a rather good tank in small tank in
yeah, it's
summer.
A small tank. I'm looking at a yeah, picture it's very, of it. Yeah,
but it's small, but it's, you know.
Looks like a Mini Cooper of tanks almost.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. But it did his job right. Against the infantry. Okay, remember that where you are infantry and without artillery cover, you're facing something like that.
Yes.
T-60 yeah. could kill
it
you.
Probably, it probably was very maneuverable.
Exactly. Yeah. But he could, they did discover that it was very difficult to use off-road in deep snow. Okay. They would become stuck. And so the enemy would open fire and shoot and, you know, destroy the tanks, particularly if there was anti-tank, German anti-tank, or even regular artillery nearby. So this was a huge problem that is going to be solved in 1 year later when T-34 becomes the, you know, the overwhelmingly most used Soviet tank in the war. Mm-hmm. Also, there is a problem with artillery distribution. We discussed this very briefly. The 16th Army in the 30th Army sector, the 16th Army, had approximately half of all artillery used during the offensive. It was concentrated in one point. The 1st Shock Army had no guns larger than 107. They had no even one 132 millimeter heavy howitzer. And this asymmetry of power was absolutely a huge problem for the Soviet, because it explains why in some sector the breakthrough was quite easy and in another sector it took forever to break the German line, because where artillery was concentrated, the advance was decisive. Where it was absent, the progress was slow. I mean, it's as simple as that. And again, we're used to think that the Soviet had everything everywhere, mm-hmm. Anytime, but this was not true. Okay, remember, is a nation that is, you know, literally resurrecting from an industrial shock that would have destroyed any other political entity. Okay, and the Germans have another problem. That is, it's interesting, but very little know. They have no defense line, but they have laid a huge minefield, okay, particularly around sensitive points. Lo and behold, the German mines don't work in this deep snow. Mm-hmm. Heavy tanks could throw straight over minefield without detonating them. And this is a huge shock.
Well, it would be, yeah, especially if you were infantry behind those yes. supposed minefields.
Exactly. And they discovered that is another of those there's a Russian epiphany. It's like, oh my God, there's a lot of snow here, and the snow might be 1 meter thick, and so mines need a solid base, not soft ground below the snow. Mm. And this was something, by the way, that it was not new, because the Winter War in Finland between, you know, the Soviet Army and the yes. Finns had already showed that, but they have just decided to ignore it. You know, it is another of those interesting German
ignore things you don't want to, that just
exactly.
get in the way of a good
exactly.
story.
Okay. So, continue on. So the Germans are having all sorts of problems. They have a problem with the terrain. They have the problem with the Soviet attack. They're having problem with partisans who are really active at this point in the German rear. And we are having... But everything, I mean, there is this sense that they are one part of the German army is not having a clear picture of what is happening, and the other part is just panicking. Would the German commander that is probably faring worse than anybody else is Guderian, actually. Mm. Guderian is doing everything wrong. He doesn't know exactly where the Soviet are. Is because of his insistence on pushing forward at any cost beyond Tula, his southern flank is horribly exposed. So he goes back. At this point, he decides that the only thing he has to do is to retreat. But to retreat where? So he goes to Hitler saying, I want requesting permission to withdraw to defensible position. And Hitler just say, defensible position where? Where are your defensible position? Okay. Yeah. And there comes around a huge confrontation that is near between the 16th and 25th. And in this confrontation of December, yes. And this confrontation, Hitler just bluntly tell Guderian, you are lost a lot of terrain. Your panzer group is in an impossible position. This is due to your decision, and now you are asking me permission to retreat, and there is I don't have an idea where your final retreat line should be. So, and December 26-25 Guderian is dismissed, and it used to be the superstar of the German commander. This create is actually a part of a huge purge inside the German commander begins in December 16, when Hitler is at this point is clear to him that the German command doesn't know how to deal with this situation. So he issued this formal hold order forbidding large scale withdrawal and requiring every position to be held to the last. Is not this singular act of military genius that someone babbles about. it was not irrelevant, but this framework of rigidity in one sense benefit the defense and benefit the cost, but is no replacement for some kind of elastic defense. Is the next best thing given the condition. Now, why Hitler is deciding this is not because he's a genius, it's not because he's seeing things better than anybody else, is just because he's obsessed with Napoleon. Is in his mind this idea of a retreat, and this is why he confronts Guderian head-on, saying, you're retreating where? Is that if they are going to retreat, they're going to be caught in the open and cut to pieces, which is partially true, but it's not... it's more, you know what they say about the clock, a broken clock show, blah, 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 blah. Right, it's more or less the same thing. So Hitler gets lucky also because the Soviet commanders in December were repeatedly failing to exploit the breaches that this German rigidity created. But this, remember, is not going to last forever. At some point Hitler becomes convinced that he is a genius because of this, and he's going to try to repeat the same mind frame later in the war. But at this point, the Soviets have learned their lesson, and they are actually exploiting those breaches. But
the lesson that the Germans will learn, because you always learn the lesson from the last battle, whatever it is, the Soviets are mentally, and racially incapable of exploiting gaps that they can create. So we can build a whole offensive and defensive strategy around that. They'll never learn. Yeah.
Okay. But what happens in practice is that there is a command catastrophe, one of the largest in the war, probably, from my point of view, maybe the most significant in terms of results, is that December 19, Hitler decided to remove Brauchitsch, the chief of the OKH, and replace him on ground of ill health, allegedly, and replace Brauchitsch with himself. say, okay, I'm fusing supreme political authority with direct operational command. Okay, so I'm eliminating any kind of institutional space for operational judgment by those Prussian I dislike. Okay, so I'm the chief of KH. And then there is a cascade of dismissal. Bock, Fyodor Bock, the chief of Army Group Center, is replaced by Kluge, von Kluge, which, by the way, is a much more submissive and timid personality. Not a bad commander, as everybody said after the war, but definitely a weak personality. It was the guy who at some point had threatened Guderian to, to fight a duel with him.
Guderian becomes a superstar again in the West after the war.
No, but he became a...
Did he have another run again?
He did return. Okay. He did return because he was a very good politician.
Okay.
But he was a very good politician from this point of view. Right. Very good at exploiting Hitler's need for adulation. Again, history repeats himself.
Yes, yes.
As you may understand.
Yes.
Then Hoeppner, then more importantly, Hoeppner, the commander of Panzer Group 4th, is dismissed on January 8th. And... stripped of his rank for unauthorized withdrawal. And this will come back to Hitler later on because Hoeppner, at this point, who was always a very fervent Nazi, decided he doesn't like really Hitler because he was, stripped of his rank, stripped of his pension, stripped of his the money, the bribes he had received during the war. And Hoeppner joins the rank, the ranks of the von Stauffenberg conspiracy plot against Hitler. Von Lieb, Army Group North, decide to resign on January 6th. And this create a psychological rupture, inside the German army, because all these people is replaced by people that Hitler consider closer to his mindset, better Nazis. Some of these people, like Reinhardt, Hoth, and so on and so forth, or Meinstein, that will come to the forefront later on, they are good commanders, but they are, Hitler to some point feels like they are more eager to subscribe to this idea that, the successful commander is the commander with the best willpower.
Mm-hmm.
Willpower is everything. But it is what it is. The situation at this point is completely changed because in any case, this clockwork machine is almost perfect. What was supposed to be a perfect clockwork machine that ran Barbarossa from the beginning is now completely broken. It did fail. It was not perfect, but it did fail in the beginning. But right now it's replaced with a completely different mechanism. On the Soviet side, things also are becoming interesting because there is this non-stop debate between Stalin, Shaposhnikov, and Zhukov about the next phase. Because right now, definitely, the Germans are being pushed back, particularly on the north and the south, quite far away from Moscow. It remains, they are still holding their ground around Rzhev, just in front of Moscow. And at this point, there is this debate where we are supposed to do. Do we have to exploit those gains in the north, in the south, or do we need to press in the center? And Zhukov started to say, at least in his memory, he contends that the resources were nearly exhausted. The first shock army that had the best run of the offensive was had to be moved north for the operation near Demyansk, near Novgorod, to try to... this operation was supposed to be this jumping point to start to break the Leningrad blockade.
Right, right.
But Stalin said, no, we need to press all along the front. And so the Soviet decided to expand the operation. And particularly, they decide to instead of concentrated or concentrating all their forces in one objective, and probably the most sensible thing to do was actually to concentrate it on Demyansk, because of the Leningrad crisis that was developing simultaneously. Remember, Leningrad was under the blockade. Yes. Hundreds of thousands of people were starving to death and so on and so forth. They decided to point toward Vyazma and Rzhev to attack at the center on a broad front with four front attacking simultaneously. On the German at this point, you're free to believe the idea came from Hitler. I mean, there are all sort of, there is a huge historiographical debate regarding this. At this point, the German are conducting this necklace, they so call it pearl necklace tactics, which is a romantic way to this idea of converting villages into interlocking strong points. Mm. Okay, they basically the German command start to say you are holding all the important center, and you are connecting all the important center with a link of villages, where of course everybody is thrown out, all the original inhabitants, and you select inside the village, you select houses with good fields of fire, burn all remaining building to create clear lanes, establish mutual fire support between position, and you create a wave of improvised strong point. In 1941, lacking heavy artillery all over the front, these kind of improvised fortification were really formidable for the Soviet advance. So this is a huge...
Because the Soviets did not have enough heavy artillery.
No, they could not concentrate. They could not concentrate enough firepower, enough mobility. They could have, if they have chosen one sector where to break through, right, not pressing all over the front, you know, with a more or less one-to-one ratio of troops. So you are going to see, we don't have time to discuss this, but we are going to see again and again and again, initial penetration, particularly by cavalry mechanized group. The cavalry, of course, in this kind of, or ski battalions, okay, in this kind of environment, they are very good for moving, and they break in some point, they encircle or threaten to encircle German pockets of German troops, and then these German groups are always relieved by camp, because the Soviet advance is slowed down by this improvised fortification, and the German are sending small but strong Kampfgruppen is a term to indicate ad hoc formation made by pieces and bits of different units under a single command. From maybe, you know, you can even use logistic troops or wounded soldier to do that. Mm-hmm. But they are using to hold junction, allowing reinforcement to come and basically make the Soviet encirclement fail. And this is starting to, I mean, we could discuss probably for another hour over episodes regarding these, where troops are being flown from East Prussia, from France, and from so on, are used to stop Soviet advances, and those Soviet advances achieved very little with huge losses. More than the single episode, I would like to have people understanding this. There is a fundamental limitation until, again, repeating myself, but this is an important point, until the Red Army fielded the tank corps and then the tank armies. A tank corps was between 6,000 and 10,000 men with armor, artillery, infantry. The task of cutting retreat routes of German division was not solvable by brigades, because individual tank brigades could seize road junctions but could not hold them against a withdrawing force with armor. Okay. This gap explained the pattern of this path of near encirclement failure with huge losses. But okay, I mean, there are many operations. There's the Lyuban operation, for instance. There is a textbook example of this. Is important because it is where General Vlasov, Andrei Vlasov, yes, that later will become famous for the
Vlasov's army, for the traitors.
Yes, Vlasov army, the traitors' army. The second shock army is used to penetrate deep into the German rear. They are surrounded, then Vlasov is captured, and then defect to the German, blah, 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 blah. But the idea is this. There is this initial victory that is followed by a series of disappointment. But one could say, okay, that is much, much ado about nothing. No, this is not true. It's important not to overstate the results and the meaning of those disappointments in January and then in February, because it is true that the original goal, extended goal of the Soviet Army to destroy completely Army Group Center, is not achieved, and the goal of Army Group Center after December 16 to stop the Soviet advance and resist, and in particularly protect the large cities in front of Moscow, like Bryansk, Vyazma, Smolensk, and so on, and so Kursk, and so on and so forth, is achieved. But at what cost? The first thing you need to understand is that the German logistic at this point is surviving, but just surviving on margins. Germany will never add the logistics and the armor strength he had in June 1941. This is gone forever. And it's not just gone forever because at some point the Soviet outperform German industrial production in every field. Is because of the attrition and the damage that is done to the German structure. In June 1941, the German logistical and supply system is able to feed an army that can advance over a front of thousands of kilometers. In 1942, only one third of that strength is left. And it's only concentrated in the southern front. There is no way Germany can repeat a Barbarossa II, because they are not that strong. But because it's gone, it's literally has been destroyed. Let's just take an example: the partisan war. The partisan war effect is so huge that at some point Germany is using the same amount of manpower and resources to protect and repair the rail lines that are destroyed by the partisans that they used in 1941 to build new railways, rail lines, in order to support the advance. Okay, they had to shift all that manpower in just keeping what they had running. They had no strength enough to have rail lines being extended. But this is important in particular because when the advance toward Stalingrad and the advance toward the Caucasus happens in 1942, there is no enough railway power to support that advance. So from the railheads to the front, everything is more and more dependent by trucks or by horse power, which we have seen as enormous limitation.
Yes.
And let's not talk, you know the picture, the production asymmetries mm-hmm. is becoming huge in 1942 and beyond. So that it's not even... and remember, very important, this is an important point, Lend-Lease in this moment is still minimal, okay? There are material that is being sent, but it's going to matter just much later. It's going to matter in the second half of 1942. So Soviet Union is really running the war on its on its own, you know, horsepower. It's what we're going to discuss this maybe in a recap episode, but and we're going to discuss also the political and social dimension of what happens. But it's important to understand that the Soviet offensive in front of Moscow in 1941, more than anything else, is the last nail in the coffin of German invincibility. Everybody thinks that the myth of German invincibility is broken in Stalingrad. But this is not really true. It may be true that for the European population in occupied countries, the idea of the German defeat in front of Moscow is more a tale of, oh my God, the winter was so harsh mm-hmm. that we could not move forward. But still, it did matter. And it did matter probably more in Germany than anywhere else. Right. This idea that we're not more invincible, we are going to have a fight, in particular that we are going to have a fight, a war of materials. And even if we think that we are the great German nation, we are capable of anything, we have the most advanced technology and the continent and blah, 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 is still this idea that maybe, just maybe, those Untermenschen in the East are going to outperform us from this point of view. So I want to close this whole episode and close, the story of Barbarossa, then we may have a recap of later on. A bonus episode. But I want to recap the story. The story of Barbarossa ends here. Okay. Barbarossa, any kind of... Barbarossa as an operation probably did end up already before Kiev. But the dream of Barbarossa ends here. It's over. It's gone. We'll never come back from this point of view. Remember... it ends up with Germany experiencing something I had not experienced in this war before. I never experienced before in this war. Because sometimes people say, well, maybe they had started to have a problem in Africa before the Moscow offensive, but the scale is completely different.
Yeah.
This kind of defeat, okay, of... It's a defeat of counteroffensive, being pushed back, having to lose hundreds of kilometers or dozens of kilometers, depends on where you are looking at the map, because the enemy is fighting back. It's nothing like that did happen since the start of the war. Okay, so it's a huge turning point. While it's not true that the war was lost because of Moscow, because probably the war was lost the moment where the first salvo of Barbarossa were fired, it is true that the real idea, the conscience of fighting a war that was not inevitably a victory, probably came to Germany in all its strength with the Soviet offensive in front of Moscow.
Right. Well, this has been a great series, Nibale, and I think everybody's really appreciates it. And you have definitely, we'll talk about it whenever we do our bonus episode, but it's definitely busted a lot of myths that have hung around for various reasons also about Barbarossa and the German fighting machine, but also the Soviets as well. A lot of myths that have that really got solidified in the Cold War, and there was no reason to remove them after that.
Right.
So, I really appreciate 10-part series on Barbarossa. This has been, as the kids say, epic. I really appreciate it. And thanks. That's our series.
Thank you.
Operation Barbarossa with Annibale, part 10. And thank you so much again to Annibale. Thank you, John and Brendan, and all of our subscribers. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.